You are listening to AI Unleashed with your host, Johnny Samwer. Tune in to hear from experts in the field and influential leaders as they share their expertise on the potential opportunities and challenges of artificial intelligence and what they believe the future might hold. Make sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hello and welcome back to AI Unleashed. Today I'm honored to talk to a guest with a wealth of experience as a managing director at the Venture Lab for Software and Artificial Intelligence at the Technical University of Munich, coupled with a background as an accomplished CEO and board member in the B2B technology sector. Holding an MBA from Harvard Business School and renowned for their expertise in small technology companies, strategy analysis of startups, fundraising, and scaling operations, they are a leading figure in the entrepreneurial landscape. As a TEDx speaker and producer of entrepreneurial realities, their dedication to fostering innovation and guiding founders through the intricacies of the startup journey is truly commendable. It is my honor to introduce Antoine Leboyer to the podcast.
Wonderful. I'm more concerned about one element, which is the intellectual property, because all of these models are trained on available data. Yeah. And I feel that the concept of fair use, which is what a lot of the technical companies are invoking to be able to defend themselves, I feel that the fair use concept is more of a big issue with AI. I remember discussing with the founder of Stable Diffusion on the fact that if someone was asking to create a painting of a cat surfing on the ocean in the style of Da Vinci or Vermeer, there wouldn't be a need to give any royalties to Da Vinci or Vermeer. But if you ask to do the same thing in the style of Bonsky, who is going to identify the royalty that needs to go to Bonsky? And, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about this. And I feel that this is something which right now is a bit murky. It's something where there is not a very clear statement. There's also no real technology that allows to say that once you are using something which you've trained on this text or this image and so on, then you can come back and say, well, you look, I owe royalty of 5% to Bonsky and 2% to the C.H. Saito. It's very difficult technically to find something that really matches the technical problem. So that to me is a far more fundamental problem with adopting AI. This being said, I want to make sure again that I'm not negative. I'm absolutely amazed by the technology. I also have lived through quite a number of technical revolution, from moving to mainframe, to mini, to PC, to the software, to the internet, to mobile, to the cloud, and so on. And I think that AI is one of the most amazing technology that is happening right now. We are really at the beginning, and there are two reasons for that. The first one is that if you look at all the other type of technical revolution that I have mentioned, you have a lot of equipment you need to buy. Let's take the example of mobile. Once the smartphone was announced, if you wanted to use this new device, you had to find one, you had to buy a data plan, which was something that was very new at the time. There was no application. So the amount of time, effort, resources, capital expenditures you have to spend to get the benefit of mobile is something which is quite significant. Whereas for AI, what we've seen is that everyone who has a browser can get AI to work. Okay? I mean, I think this is really important to realize this. One of the reasons that ChatGPT took off like crazy is that anyone who goes to ChatGPT and asks a question gets an answer. The answer can be good, the answer can be bad. There could be some hallucination, or it could be just simply perfect, but everyone gets an answer. Where else can you find something of this importance that gives you as much capabilities to use? Again, think of the mobile. You know, everyone has been watching, everyone in my generation watched the keynote of the iPhone. It doesn't mean that the following day we could start all using an iPhone and have a a huge amount of application which we could use. That's not the case with AI, and this is why I think this is important. The other reason that I want to highlight, which is for the importance of AI, is that while we are still at the beginning, there are huge amount of business application. The financial return is unbelievable. So I have discussed with quite a number of people who are in large organization, and what they say is that because of the age pyramid, there's going to be a lot of people who will retire. And they are viewing the ability to increase the productivity of their employee using AI as the key to be able to overcome the fact that they can't hire as many people as those which are going to be leaving. So this is something which is going to be massive. We're not, you know, I'm not a big fan of social media, which I think is a big waste of time. I don't think there is a return of investment on social media, and I would even argue that, you know, just basing an application just on the amount of attention that you can get to be able to do advertising is as important as what you can get right now from AI. So this is why I feel I'm very, very, very bullish on AI.
I agree. I wanted to come back to the first point. You said that we focus too much on like the AI safety side of things right now. I feel like we're trying to regulate AI in a way that's treating it as if it's already like conscious or like has this AGI, so this artificial general intelligence aspect to it, which obviously right now we're not at the point yet. So yeah, I think definitely we're trying to regulate it too much for how little it is right now. And I think one thing we should regulate, or what I've seen, is definitely like these deep fakes where you can't really tell what's the difference. So like there have been like a couple of viral pictures that gone around that are fakes. So I think that's one thing we should be careful of. But I agree that we should focus on improving the technology more. And then once we reach this stage where it has become like way more advanced, then we can focus on regulating it.
The first one is that for deepfake, I think that there should be a mandate to have specific metadata,
yeah,
which could be linked with every image generated by an AI system. And when you think of this, you and I know this is technically feasible. So I would recommend that every time that system is going to be producing an image, there is some sort of metadata which could be all the same across all the system, across all the countries, so that you can identify if this is something which has been created by an AI. And that to me would be the very first thing. The other thing that I want to say is that while I am not a huge fan of regulation, because you know I was a former entrepreneur, and I feel that in Europe in particular, where you've got fragmented market, and over-regulation is not something which helps, I still want to add that there is one positive thing in the EU AI Act, which is that they are asking companies, developers who are deploying an application to think in terms of risk. And I would argue with you that it's not stupid. It makes some sense to say to someone, the governance for an application is something that you're going to have to work out. And the way you should think of it would be about risk. So this would be something where I would say that this is something which does have some sense. I really would like that the EU and many regulatory bodies also try to come with ways of promoting innovation, and in particular in Europe for startup. So I think that just coming with the EU Act should be a small part of their activities. But and this is more my problem. But asking people to think about how risky these applications are is very important. And you know, for many, I've spoken to quite a number of people, and the classic way you deploy an application with classic IT is something which has nothing to do with AI. If you want to do the maintenance of a classic application, it's something where there are a lot of methodologies, metrics, governance system. But for AI, you know, what happens if suddenly you get the ability to add this amount of data and then you realize that there was a bias that you hadn't been seeing? So there are a number of tools which exist to be able to get metrics on AI, but I think that we are at the beginning. And if I had to look for a startup to build, I would actually try to look in something which would allow to define a governance and a lifetime system for AI applications, because I think this is going to be unbelievably important when a lot of application will move from testing to production.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think like the big power in AI, as you mentioned before, is like that you can really, or that it can solve like big problems that we have right now in the world, or like just increase efficiency at like not at like easy solutions. Like I've coded like some large or like some models myself, and it's not that difficult to actually like create a working model that has a like high accuracy in something. So yeah, I think that's where like the strong power of AI lies. And you also mentioned like the rise of ChatGPT, and I think what changed in the past, or in the last, let's say, 10 years for AI, is that people realize that one has to create a like easier user interface for people, and like so that it gains popularity and make it more accessible to the public, which I think ChatGPT, or with OpenAI, was the first company to really realize that, and that's why it took off so fast.
You may not remember when browser, you know, you may not have been even when we were born, where browsers started appearing, but there was a story of someone that was using Google, and from time to time he would send a mail to Google with a number which I think was 25, and sometime he would send a number and it would be 26, until they realized that the guy was complaining when there would be more than 26 words on the homepage of Google. And a lot of what we've seen with mobile, but also with Google, has been to work on the user interface. And I feel that I quite like the user interface OpenAI. I feel that this has been done with usability in mind. And I think that this is something that's important. So I do encourage people that look at applications to really work on the usability. I also want to mention a story. So before I was at the Technical University of Munich running the Venture Lab, I was running a software company. And I read the book which was written by Walter Isaacson and Steve Jobs. If you haven't read it, very, very strong book, very interesting, captivating. It should be mandatory reading. But I remember looking at the way Isaacson described how Jobs was working with designers, until the design would be something that was really good. Mm-hmm. The following day, I reached out and I heard for the first time someone that was in charge of all the UX, all the user interface of our products, because I started realizing that we had three products with incompatible user interface, which led to incompatible user experience, and that we had to do something to be able to correct this. It proved to be a wonderful hire, a wonderful girl who after a few years, became the product manager because of the work that she had to do. Suddenly she developed a very strong understanding of the value of the product, of the way it was being used, and it was a very natural evolution. So I cannot stress enough how much having a good UX is something which is important for every application, mobile or laptop, classic software or AI.
Yeah, I agree. I think obviously a user interface is like the first thing that you see, and even if your product is the best, you can have a bad user interface where it's difficult for the person to understand how to use the product. I think, yeah, the user interface is the most important part. You mentioned like your venture lab. Can you maybe like share more about like your role at the venture lab for like software and like AI at TUM?
So I'm the managing director of the Software and AI Venture Lab. And the Venture Lab has been created a little less than 3 years ago with the idea of helping entrepreneurs which come with a deep tech and scientific background and trying to help them to develop domain-specific support project to be able to support startup. With me, you have a number of ventures on other domain like quantum technology, the chemical environment, aerospace, sustainability, mobility, build environment. There's a very active venture lab on legal tech startup and so on. There's one on healthcare, which is also very active. And what we do is that we are an organization which is in terms of structure, part of TUM and part of this organization called Unter named TUM, where you have a huge number of innovation and publishing program. And we work currently at the Software and AI Venture Lab with about, I would say, 100 plus startups. There are some more startups in the Data University, but they are a little early. And we have had strong discussion with about 100 of them. Out of these, if you look at last year result, well, you may have 10 which have disappeared, and that's absolutely normal. There are 20 startups which got this German stipend called Exist, which is something which is unbelievably important for strong entrepreneurs in Germany. We have three which are cash positive, and we have two which got acquired. I even have one which got acquired for Agigit after less than 3 years, which is really amazing. And we look also at something which is the amount raised by first-time startup. So 2 years ago, it was 6 million euro, and last year it was double amount. And this is coming at a time when you have minus 35% of venture capital funding. So it shows the appetite and the interest and the ability, if you are a deep tech founder, even coming out of the university, to be able to raise funding and move forward. And as I was telling you, we have one of, for instance, one of the youngest founders that we have has just turned 20. His name is Florian Schell, and he runs a startup called Fast AI Movies. And he started 3 years ago. He's got 10 employees and 22 customers. And we are thrilled to be able to develop programs, to be able to support people like him, as well as all the others. And this is what we do.
Yeah, that's really interesting. What did your day-to-day look like? Did you just go around and talk to all these different startups that you're interested in then?
If I can, if this is my day, I take it as any day. So I wish that I could really do this because that's huge value. But if I step back and if I look at what we do, we have three type of main activities to be able to support startup. The first thing that we do is that we've developed content, training, event, which aims at number one, inspiring startup, inspiring founders, trying to communicate what this is. And number two, to be able to give them the sort of complementary information and know-how that you need to have if you are working on a startup. And again, TUM and the German system produces very strong engineers. And it's important to add on top of this knowledge, which is very strong and sometimes a bit theoretical, what is related to entrepreneurship. And then we've developed quite a lot of content that we do and we deploy and we give this content regularly. The second thing that I have done is that I've tried very early to be able to develop a network of people which are going to be important for the startup. One of the first thing I did when I arrived was to go and see the early stage deep tech venture capitalists which exist in Germany. And I have to say that, we have some very, very, very strong venture capitalists who really understand deep tech, who understand AI, and who are people that we are really happy to have in our network. The other people which are very important, which I have started visiting, are the head of innovation of local companies. And there are many of them whom we work with at, via the YouTube network. And the importance for startup for developing a relation with these people is the following. A startup is going to make progress once they have a first product, when they have done something like a first pass, by getting feedback. And so developing the ability to be able to develop a network of people who are interested in the innovation that is coming out of this startup from the university, being able to be the first people using this, giving feedback, is exactly the way that the startup can be developing and blossoming. And we've created a number of contact presentation networks where the startup, once they pass a certain level of capabilities, we put them in front of the right people and they find people which could be saying, hold on, this is really interesting. Can we work together? So we've developed this thing, this network. This is something that was very, very important. And then the third thing that I do along, and I have two colleagues who work with me on this. There's one who is currently at the Heilbronn campus called Jan Mittendorf, and one who works with me in Munich whose name is Bastian Berger. And the three of us, we spend a lot of time helping, mentoring, supporting the startup, whatever the sort of issue which they are facing, and we try to meet and to work with them regularly. I used to have a board of director in my company, and I always was wondering what my company would have been if I had been able to get access to the sort of network and support and capabilities. And both Jan, Bastian, myself, we are all the three of us former entrepreneurs. We want to, in a way, to create the support structure that we would have been, we would have liked to have had before. And this is what we do. So there's not one day which looks like the same, but if you step back, these are the three things that we do.
Yeah, really interesting. You mentioned before that you had your own startup or your own company. With your experience as a CEO and like board member in the B2B sector, how did you like transition into like from the academic space into like the entrepreneurial space?
So I run my company from 2008 until 2020, and then I sold my company, and I wanted to be in a situation where I could give back. I felt that I had been very fortunate personally because of the universities I went, the support I got, and I wanted to be in a situation where I could be giving back. And the only thing that I really know well are startup and software and AI. And just as I'm Swiss, I have been helping a few startups at the Lausanne EPFL. And I wanted to be able to do this in a much more systematic environment. I discussed with a few universities and I heard about the Venture Lab, and I called the Venture Lab, and I found that this was a place which was exactly what I was looking for. On top of that, I have to say that I've been very impressed by the quality of my colleagues and the quality of the environment of the people which I meet at TUM and at UTUM. And all of us at the Venture Lab, we are really here because we want to help young entrepreneurs. So I would say that it has been a very natural transition. And also it is something which is a great source of satisfaction. Once again, I work with amazing founders who are very dynamic and who have got a lot of ideas and who are entrepreneurial and innovative, and be able to add something to be helping them is something which is, which is a blessing.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned, obviously, we talked a lot about the startups and obviously AI. What do you think are like the biggest opportunities for startups in the field of AI? I mean, we talked before about like the part where you can solve like big problems with like AI that is not really that hard to code or hard to create. Yeah, but like, what do you think should startups focus on when it comes to AI?
So I think that to answer these questions, you have to break it in two parts. The first one is how to start a startup, and the other one is what happens with AI. So on the first one, I really want to insist on the following. If you want to do a startup, you need to be able to have something that gets you started, an idea. And an idea is not a technology per se. An idea is not, I've coded two or three things and so on. An idea is that something can be done differently and it makes value. And people could be seeing so much value that at some stage, they wouldn't want the system to be disconnected and they were ready to give money to someone for this. So at the base, it really comes like there's something we could do differently. I have one startup which has developed an AI front end to be able to help hospitals onboard clients and patients when they come for the first time. And the founder is someone who has, I think that he's a bachelor. He's done a wonderful job technically speaking, but what really struck me is how much he understands what happens when a patient knocks at the door of hospital. So I asked him where he got the idea, and he laughed and he told me that both of his parents work at Caritas. So every evening, or one evening out of two, what would they speak about? They would speak about their day. They would speak about the patients. And by listening to this, he started developing a sense for what was their day. And when he became AI proficient, suddenly all this accumulated knowledge of how they work and the problem they were actually encountering, all of this allowed him to understand what to develop. I usually joke and I say that what is important for a founder is not the problem they solve, it's the question they are asking. And an entrepreneur is someone who both identifies an answer, but more importantly, who identifies a problem. So this is something which is at the heart of the entrepreneurial approach. When it comes to AI, I would say that one of the challenges is the defensibility. And we have seen huge amount of money and data by some of the players which exist right now. So I don't know how feasible this is to be able to go head-to-head with NVIDIA or to come with a new large language foundational model and so on. But that doesn't mean that you cannot develop defensibility. And the startup that we have at the university, whom I have, you know, good feeling, are those which are combining domain knowledge as well as, you know, strong technology. I once again want to say that's also one of the strongest defensibilities is the data. So the one of the startups which I worked with, which got significant funding, they had the idea of gathering data that people would not have been having. So I think that this is something that is one of the biggest elements. But every time that I speak with a founder, I try to look at if they have clearly identified something as a problem and if they have the ability to identify data to be able to have defensibility when they discuss. And pretty often, by the way, this is the case, which is really cool.
Yeah, definitely. You talked about data, and obviously data is like the ground or the groundwork for AI. Are there any like specific industries where you see like faster or like slower adoption of AI? And obviously, I would presume that the industries which do not have a lot of data or like not great access or not organized data obviously adopt AI slower than the ones, for example, that have a lot of data.
I would agree with you. I think that one of the most important thing to do if you are running a company is that you need to start realizing how important your data is and how you need to use this strategically speaking. I have one example that I would like to give, because it's also something which to me is the best practice of a startup working with a Mittelstand company in Germany. I have on the stand on the Venture Lab a company which is called Sizekick. And the founder, Dave and Jake, who are amazing guys, developed a small application, a first application which is using the camera of a smartphone to be able to help scan and tell you if you need to buy a t-shirt of size 33 or 34. They've refined this, and the idea of this is that this is something which could be used by e-tailers so that you reduce the amount of product returns. So it's something which is with a very clear positive benefit. If the e-tailers which are adopting the API which have been developed by this startup, they want to reduce their stock return, and it's very good for the environment as well as for their bottom line. They worked with a company which is what I would call the incumbent, the company which has got 1,000 people which develops this sort of measurement, but from a classic method. And this is really great, because what you have is that, you know, there you have a company, an incumbent, which has been financing them instead of a venture capitalist. But also they really work together. And for the startup, they got access to their data. And for the incumbent, they got access to an entrepreneurial spirit, the ability of some people to go very fast, and they wouldn't have had this sort of capabilities if they had been hiring internally. So it's a very strong win-win. And you know, the thing that was really good is that the startup could use the data of the incumbent much faster and much better than they would have been able to do themselves. So this is something that I think is to me a best practice, and I'm very impressed with what they've been doing. They are doing really well.
Yeah, definitely. That's really interesting. Looking back at your career path, what piece of advice would you wish someone had given you when you were like starting your career in the startup scene and studying?
I need to think about this, because when I started, when you were doing well, people told you that you got to go in big companies and start learning as much, and then you go into a smaller company and so on. 20 years ago, people said to you, go into a consulting firm, you know, back in BCG or McKinsey, and then do something else. And these days, the cool guys, they directly go into a startup. So I have to say that I really wish that I had gone into a startup from day one or into small companies. I feel that small companies are important. The first thing that I would like to say is that you have two types of position. You have what I would call operational position and back office position. If you're in operation, you've got very clear objectives. You need to be delivering a project. You need to be closing a contract with a customer. You need to be able to produce either a physical product or deliver some code and so on. I feel that these are these positions that you need to be having. I think these positions are very, very important. I know that I have, you know, unbelievable people, unbelievably smart, who are in consulting firm. I'm impressed by the ability to be able to formalize abstract thinking and to be able to communicate. But the issue with them is that I don't know if they learn on the consequence of their recommendations, because they don't have necessarily to live with this. But again, you know, I don't want to be negative, because I'm working with amazing people. But I think that working on operations is very, very, very important. The other thing that I feel is really important is that I had not realized this, but one of the biggest value of being at university is the network, the people you meet. I think that, you know, half of the value of being to a quality university or school are the people which you meet.